Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Rahal had every right to be proud of Son of the People, and he favored him over all the others. For he, like Rahal, was a master of the knockout punch. He had the same lightning-quick knee that the squirrel often used to smash his adversaries' faces in his dreams. Son of the People, quite simply, cuts to the chase. He hates trickery and beating around the bush. His material is always at the ready. Charges of treason, accusations of conspiring with Mukhabarat's agents, going after his adversary's honor as well as that of his mother, his wife, his daughters, and his aunts, and presenting embarrassing facts about him. Son of the People always made sure that a bit of the information he presented was true in order to guarantee the trust of the readers, especially those who intimately knew the targeted person. After that, level as many false charges as you can. Son of the People is particularly keen on preserving the reader's trust, even though they don't really read. Most of them just peer down from the balcony of the title at the picture, accompanying the subject, and then begin to look for Son of the People's response. After, say, 20 comments in which they discuss the article's subject, they agree or disagree with the author. They attack or defend the person who produced the article. Then Son of the People fires off a shot and the comments follow one after the other. 40, 50, 100, 200. Most of them don't return to the original article to discuss it. Rather, they move around in Son of the People's universe. They recall his words. They interact with him. Sometimes they might disagree with him, but with him and his comment, not with the article and its subject.
Welcome to episode 86 of the Bulaq podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay, and reading to you just now was our guest for today, Professor and translator Alex Ellinson, reading from Yasin Adnan's Hot Mohawk, a novel that features a novel that I suppose could be described as an internet novel, as many Anglophone novels are being described these days, that deals with online life, that's set to a large extent in a cyber cafe. We were just hearing a description of the online persona that is taken up by its main character. So we're very pleased to have you with us today, Alex, and of course also, as always, Marsha Links-Quayle, my co-host, is with us as well in Rabat.
Hi, Ursula.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
So Alexander Ellinson is Associate Professor of Arabic Language and Literature and Head of the Arabic Program at Hunter College, City University of New York. He's author of Looking Back at Al-Andalus, The Poetics of Loss and Nostalgia in Medieval Arabic and Hebrew Literature. His translations include two novels by Yusuf Fadel, A Beautiful Cat, White Cat Walks With Me and A Shimmering Red Fish Swims With Me, which are part of a trilogy. And he also is the translator, of course, of Yasin Adnan's Hot Mohawk, as well as many other short works, many of them by Moroccan authors. So thank you so much, Alex, for coming today to talk with us about this very fun, sprawling, critical novel.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So perhaps we should start just by giving people an introduction to the basic the main characters, the basic story of this book, although that is challenging because that story sort of unspools in a number of directions. But if you don't mind giving a summary as best one can.
Sure. I mean, I'll give a very brief summary because, as you said, to go into any details might take us in many different directions. But basically, this is the story. It's a story that revolves around a single character, and I'm not going to call him a hero or even an anti-hero, but our protagonist, Rahal Rina. He is a young man who grew up in Marrakesh, the only child of parents very modest means, and spent much of his childhood and young adulthood being bullied, feeling ashamed of where he comes from, feeling bad about who he is, and, trying to find his voice after, many sort of attempts at doing so. He has a very vivid imagination, and this is what sort of takes him through his early years. He finds his voice in the early 90s, when something called the internet appears in Morocco and around the world. And it's through the internet, it's in the internet and, that he really comes into himself. And of course, it's ironic because the self that he comes into is a series of characters that he creates, or personas or avatars that he creates, and he quickly figures out how to become liked, how to become popular, and how to gather as many friends as possible as he can around him in the online world. And I mean, so this is the basic framework of the story, and he ends up opening an internet cafe or becoming manager of an internet cafe in Marrakesh. And, generally the novel follows him both in real life and online, as well as a large cast of characters that he comes into contact with in middle school, high school, university, and afterwards in his career as a cyber cafe manager and online troll. And the book touches upon Arabic culture and popular culture and Marrakesh history, Moroccan history, Arab history. It deals with issues of social and economic change, political, the political discourse and scene in contemporary Morocco as well. And so it touches upon a lot of themes. I'm very happy to talk today more about it with you all.
Great. And I would say that this moment that you read from at the beginning is sort of the high point of his writing career, in that it's his full freedom of expression. He's creating these characters that exist in the comments, and he's getting so much positive, feedback for it. But it's before he's come under the thumb of the Mukhabarat, of the government, before he's sort of writing to order, writing to government directives. There's all sorts of these wonderful reversals and flips back and forth in he is at the top of the world, of course, hidden. Nobody knows that this is really him, but, and then before this becomes, a job writing.
Right. Because I think it is important to mention that he's not just an internet troll, he's a paid internet troll who's working as part of a highly manipulated online media and social media environment in which the state and the intelligence services are actually directing you know, the public discourse through various means of control, either by, you know, controlling outlets or controlling columnists or controlling people like him. So there's a real heavy focus actually on the behind the scenes state manipulation of these spaces for public expression, which is somebody who is a journalist and lived in Morocco, I found very interesting.
Yeah. And I think just to maybe say it in different words or to add a little bit, I mean, it really is so, it's so disappointing and sad, you know, when we, in a sort of ironic way, because we do see that Rahal, this protagonist, does come. He finally finds his voice in the internet. He finally is able to express himself and to be anyone he wants to be. And in fact, he is multiple people at the same time online. And our first sense is this freedom that the internet provides him, and this voice and this platform for free expression, which, you know, I mean, there are no free platform goes un you know, unexamined in a place like Morocco. And it's true that the Mukhabarat and the security service, the intelligence agencies, figure out very quickly the power of this platform and very quickly find him and co-opt him. And I mean, he's not an employee of the state at the beginning of his career. He's just a guy having a blast on this new internet. But very quickly becomes a tool of the state, to spy on people, to manipulate, messaging, and to control what is said and what's not said on the internet.
Although even when he is free and he is enjoying himself, but what he's actually doing from the beginning is like pretty awful. Like the way he enjoys the internet is to spread. He on his own, before he's even paid to do it, is making false accusations and spreading rumors and smearing people he's jealous of, and engaging in the same behavior he engaged in high school, where he wrote rumors about other kids on the walls of the bathroom. So, I mean, but this is part of the novel. Like he's an unsympathetic character, as is pretty much everybody else in the book. I mean, he's certainly not a heroic character. And so his behavior, even before it's co-opted from the state, is not particularly admirable. And so in fact, it's a sort of this intimation that, you know, the way society uses the internet before the state even intervenes is not particularly positive. And then there's this level of co-optation that comes on top of it. But again and again in the book, the way people use their platforms is like very self-interested and very irresponsible, and they lie all the time, and they harm each other. So it's a pretty dark view also of like how society engages with language, going all the way back to how the kids are in high school, how the, you know, politicized university students are at university. He kind of, you know, right? He goes through just endless different forms of language and discussion and expression and discourse, and like kind of demolishes them one after the other.
Yeah, I guess I'm more sympathetic to him than that. I thought at least he was enjoying himself when there he was undermining the work of Wafi, you know, this poet.
But he's motivated entirely by spite.
Well, yes. But yeah. he was having fun doing it. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not at all implying that he's someone I would like, or you would like, or anyone would like, or even, you know, condoning anything that he's doing online. But he has, but regardless, and he is doing everything out of spite. But he is doing what he never felt he could do before. And I think, yeah, we don't have to like him, and I don't think I wonder who does like him, but. I definitely, when I saw him that first graffiti that he scratched, that very awful graffiti that he scratched on the door of the toilet stall. And the literal relief that he felt when upon doing it, I felt good for him. I was happy for him that he was finally able. I was not happy for the targets of his barbs, but you know, happy that he had found a voice. And what I think is also is so interesting, and you mentioned that it can be this idea of an internet novel, and it very much is an internet novel in that much of what happens in the latter part of the book occurs on the internet. But I think it is so interesting and important to think about everything, to remember that everything that happens on the internet, that the internet did not invent this type of discourse. I think, as you mentioned before, that the internet is just another way of doing what humans have been doing forever. You know, it's more efficient, perhaps, but it's just another bathroom door, a stall.
Right, and another and the sort of state co-optation is not particularly different from the state bringing in newspaper writers or poets, 500 years ago into its circle. But I did think of the character. I think Hassanea has some affection for Rahel. When he's gone until 3 in the morning after he's kidnapped by the Mukhabarat, she's worried about him. Yes, his wife. So, you know, even though, you know, be stretched to say she loves him, she definitely has developed some affection for him.
I'll give him that.
I think that one can feel sympathy for this character. I think that he manages to thread this very fine line where he is pathetic and yet sympathetic, like for that exact reason. And the emotion of basically jealousy, which is what the book opens with, right? It opens with him being overwhelmed with jealousy for this popular poet at his university when he's a student, is a universal human emotion. So it's a powerful emotional entryway into that character's point of view. He is then he's an unreliable narrator in the sense that you never can tell if this other poet is as bad as he thinks. You know, everybody's always criticizing each other's writing in this book, each other's expression, saying, that so-and-so isn't a good writer, so-and-so isn't a good poet, so-and-so is a sellout. You never kind of can tell if anybody's any good at all. It's a book that's right up my alley for this reason. Like, it's all about journalists, writers, literati, like people who work in language, around language. It definitely spoke to me.
Yeah, it's a great book for those of us who are interested in not just the power, but also the gossip that surrounds the literary world. And because there are this number of layers of characters, and I do think that if Rahel had been, say, like a pop novel, a Dan Brown sort of writer, I think he really could have found his audience and his space. I think his talent was sadly underutilized. But there are all kinds of, one of my, it's interesting because it is a satiric work with such a large cast of characters, none of them is really, you're not like, in depth in their in their emotional life for the most part, but many of the characters, the unlikable characters, I felt a strong sympathy for. One of them, this terrible columnist, awful sellout, Naim Marzouk, who is sort of top of the world. One of Rahel's directives is to basically go in and support whatever Naim says. That's what goes. Naim gets his directives from the state, and then Rahel and a sort of a legion of other people in the comments also, you know, put their spin on it as well. But, you know, because he's, you know, he also, you know, none of these characters is in a position that's safe. He also is manipulated into attacking the wrong person in his column, and he ends up in prison. And I just found the dynamics of, and then suddenly there he is feeling grimy and out of sorts, and he doesn't have his latte and he doesn't have his shower. And, you know, even though he's a terrible person, he's made awful, selfish decisions with his life. I did sympathize with him on a human level.
Right. But that what's so interesting, I agree with you. But then up to a point, because then, you know, after all of that happens, what you just described, and he's duped into taking down the wrong person, and he ends up in prison for that. He becomes a hero, and he's lionized for this brave stance that he's, and he becomes yet another, you know, I mean, I guess I feel for him in some way. But at the same time, he capitalizes on this hero worship that he receives for something that he had no, you know, he was not at all deserving of, I suppose.
Right. An international uproar about the arrest of this terrible, slimy writer.
Yeah. And he becomes symbol of freedom of press and, you know, right. All of that. You know, totally out of his control. And so, and he ends up, you know, he ends up becoming the beneficiary of the yet more lies, you know. And so I do feel for him, but then he ends up accepting it, this role yet again, this role that he might not deserve.
Right, the resilience of some of these characters who are taken down, like the gentleman who I can't remember, is he Emmett? Who owns the internet cafe and who is Rahel's employer. You know, Rahel manages to sort of very briefly kind of take him down through one of his, you know, his characters when he's one of the men who slide into Hiem, this beautiful woman character that Rahel has created on Facebook. And Rahel manages to, you know, sort of manipulate him into a relationship and spill the beans to his wife. But he bounces back. I mean, some of the men in particular have a great deal of resilience in the face of trolling as well.
I mean, you know, it has this picaresque quality, this story, which I think is part of, I mean, there's a number of books that I have been written in this style. I know Egyptian literature the best, but like even The Men Who Swallowed the Sun, which we discussed recently, Marcia, you know, this kind of like very episodic, sprawling, kind of funny, and like you said, ups and downs of many characters, not really focus more, I think, on events than psychology. I think going all the way back to a book like The Women of Karantina, again, like very atmospheric, gives you a place, gives you a time, gives you a kind of panorama of sort of phenomenon. But I think that the interest, I mean, the way I read it is like, it's not really about the individual characters. Like the characters are all sort of exemplifying sort of dynamics, right? I mean, that's not to say that they're not, you know, vivid when they get their time in the spotlight, but it's really about the, again, all these different forms of speaking, of lying, of using language in different ways, you know, from bathroom graffiti to university theses to newspaper columns to political speeches. He really kind of goes through to internet forums, of course, you know, all these different uses of language. And the characters are all sort of there to like show you kind of a different phenomenon, sociolinguistic phenomenons, right? Like ways in which language is being used in Morocco today, or misused for the most part. And what strikes me is also how deeply cynical this book, I mean, how really in a way, despite the light tone, how really black the picture it paints is, because there is nobody has principles. Nobody tells the truth. Nobody ever takes a stance. Everybody is endlessly, you know, flexible and co-optable. And it's starting with our main narrator, who is, you know, a complete coward, understandably so, but it's, you know, the people in power are constantly lying and manipulating. The other people are just trying to get by. And there's no examples of like a genuine journalist or a real artist or anybody whose language is like actually speaking, you know, who's, no, right. You don't know if the poet is a real poet.
We never see him do anything terrible or opportunistic. He does seem absurd, you know, there in Marseille drinking his wine. He seems ludicrous, you know, butterflies to the slaughterhouse, but not evil.
No, I'm not saying evil, but I'm saying there's nobody respectable in the entire, like there is nowhere to put, I mean, oh, this is my question. Like, is there hope where is any sort of respect or meaning? There doesn't have to be. I mean, besides the act of writing the novel itself, which is obviously an act of belief in what literature can do and writing can do. But in the novel itself, there's like no escape.
Yeah. I mean, the question, is there hope? I mean, I think within this novel, it feels not very hopeful at all. I mean, as you say, journalism is nothing but lies. Democracy is a joke. It's a game. That there, you know, there are winners that we already know who's going to win. I mean, both the elections, but the game itself. I mean, the losers of elections are winners anyway, because they share in the power. The student movements mean nothing. The political rhetoric at university means nothing. There are no friendships. There are only rivalries. There's only antagonistic relationships. There's only people attacking one another. And there is little hope in this novel. I don't know what more to say about that. I mean, I can come back to that. I mean, but what you were saying, describing this as sort of a picaresque, style narrative. I mean, it is true. I mean, the cast of characters, I think I started at one point to list the characters, maybe even to include it, a list at the beginning, for readers to help out, but it started to feel, futile. I mean, there are so many characters and with so many different, sort of stories. Yassine Adnan, the author, he does a very good job Ursula, as you said, when a character shows up, when they're given the spotlight, he does a very good job of presenting them as people with backgrounds and motivations and reasons for doing, saying, feeling, what they are doing, saying, or feeling. But it's dizzying what's going on. And I don't mean this is not a criticism at all. In fact, this is, I think, how the novel is supposed to be taken. It's a novel, and I know that the author is very proud of Marrakesh. She's a lover of Marrakesh, and it's very much a novel of the city of Marrakesh. And I mean, speaking to you from New York City, I can also say, the chaos that's out there, and it's almost irrelevant that I'm in a big city. The chaos inside our heads is so great, and online is so great, which I think he captures very nicely. That doesn't speak to the hope question. I'm sorry.
But if there's one character that comes off well in the novel, it's the city of Marrakesh. Yeah. That one character that he clearly has affection for, it's the city.
But I think very true. But I think, again, to you know, I mean, we don't have to weigh in on each of the characters, whether we like or, you know, whether it's a thumbs up or a thumbs down or a like or a dislike. But I think that he has, that Yassine, the author or the novel, has, you know, sympathy for most of the characters, not maybe not all of them, but most of them. You know, they all are who they are for reasons that were given. I mean, that he's sure to sort of present to us. You know, whether it's, I mean, Rahal is the easiest one to talk about. I mean, he is unlikable, but I hope that that no one would ever see me as a Rahal-like character. But who hasn't been jealous? I mean, Ursula, you mentioned jealousy, but all of the emotions and all of the insecurities that he feels are so so relatable, and I think that goes for. You know, I will say most of the characters. There are some that I would love to never ever hear from again. I think there is a real affection for the city, but I think there is a real sympathy for all of these characters that he's created.
Yeah, I guess the ones that occur to me as blank are the Mukhabarat characters. Mm-hmm. I don't remember feeling, even when he was back at university with them, that they had a backstory.
Right.
But I do think I like the fact that he chose to have a character who is involved in that world explicitly. I mean, I think that's such an important, actually, aspect of life that's an interesting story to tell someone who's been recruited. It's interesting to have someone who's a troll. It's interesting to have someone who's not, you know, behaving particularly well. I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I think I read somewhere that the genesis partly for this story was the author's own experience online of some of the interactions he had with people. So then he sort of started to imagine who some of these people might be. Is that at all true? Is that just a rumor?
No. That is true. I mean, as I understand it, Yassine was, I don't know if it was about particular things he was writing, but at a certain period of time, he became the target of one or more trolls. And I think quite rightly, he was, he was hurt, he was injured, he was, all, you know, shocked and pretty, you know, I think I can say dumbfounded, you know, that people could be so cruel and so heartless and so cold, tireless in their targeting of him and his work. I think this novel, I believe, started as a short story, as an examination of the troll as a personality, and who would do this? Why and why would they do it? And I think the short story became a long novel. I'm sure there's more to say on what motivates people, you know, with such hatred and such tenacity.
Mm. Right, but I don't know. You know, is it hatred? I'd say, you know, with Rahel, you know, the sort of genesis is trolling this poet, but he also loves him in a way.
Mm. He can't live without him at one point, I think he says. He
right, exactly, exactly. One of the interesting things I found, I thought Rahel really succeeded in writing female characters. He has Hiam's Facebook page that he updates, and people really seem to find her a believable character. And I also felt that Yassine did a lovely job of depicting the women characters, none of, you know, as we said, none of whom are sort of in depth. You know, we're not like, you know, getting a sort of psychological portrait of any of them. But in particular, his wife, Hassaneya, from the moment they started to work together on their graduation project, I felt, oh, she's going to railroad him into marrying her. And then the sort of the wonderful scene of the first night of their marriage, which I found really so hilarious. Not, I guess relatable is the wrong word, but I just believed so deeply that this happened.
Wait, this is the scene where I think I should just read a tiny bit from it so people get a sense, right? Because this is, shall I?
Yes.
Please.
He has a few references for what this first night should be like. And he's mentally thinking about some of these books he's read. And so it says, he tried to be charming. It was his chance to set the mood and try out the methods of sexual diplomacy that the book's author had devoted an entire chapter to. Why should I turn out the light, Hassaniya? I want to inspect my land, to lay eyes on where I'll sow and plant my seed, to wander around my garden, to see the pomegranate ripen and the apple redden, to survey the patch of mint before I water it. What mint? What shit are you talking about? Rahel, I told you to turn out the light.
And she, I can't remember the exact wording, but something of, don't touch me like that. I don't want any of this porn nonsense. Just right. Get in there, finish your business and move on.
I actually read it as, I think I read it as quite sad, their relationship, because it is again one in which there is no sexual fulfillment. There is no like sexual self-expression. It is in fact a very like, you know, meager physical connection in which her interpretation of what it should be like means that she doesn't seem to, you know, she seems to find it inappropriate to really let herself go in any way or even to feel pleasure in it, and which then denies him pleasure. And so these encounters are again part of his kind of, you know, the patheticness of his life, and his wife, who is a vivid character and sort of tough and a bit funny, but she's also a comic character in her, you know, she's the hedgehog. She's a little shrill. She's a bit of a nag. She's a bit of a bully. It's again, part of his, he's a henpecked husband. Mm-hmm. So, there's humor, but there's sadness for me too, a lot actually in that marriage, in that depiction of relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I mean that scene in particular sort of is the beginning, or the beginning of their marriage and their first night, and it the loneliness. There was so much that I felt for Rahel in those moments that, I mean, all he had was this cheap sex manual that he was relying on, or these snippets that he had read here and there for how to please a woman or how to do sex. There was something about that really, I mean, really for me was so lonely, you know, that he has nobody, you know, no one to talk to about anything, nowhere, you know, no one to talk to about being nervous, being anxious, being not knowing something, seeking advice. And it was just, I think, yeah, so well depicted in that scene that this is the beginning of a very lonely marriage, I think, for both of them.
Although I think maybe you could say that if you don't think that there's no depiction of a loving marriage, certainly. I think most of the marriages in the novel tend towards this sort of henpecked, clearly Rahel's parents were in this model. Imed and Hiam are in that range as well. I thought it was interesting. There is this moment where, you know, the scene in the mosque where the imam is giving his sermon, and he sort of, until this point, you know, in all these relationships, the woman is sort of kind of oddly in charge in this kind of picaresque, satiric, comic way. You know, you know, a domestic abuse situation would just not be funny. He comes right up into the edge to saying, women should be beaten. It's halal to beat your wife.
There's a protest in the sermon.
And then there's a protest afterwards, and it comes right up to the edge of this the protesting women are going to be beaten. And then they're actually sort of, the hand of God comes in and sweeps them off the page.
But which is entirely realistic. They would get beat. Like, been in street protests by feminists protesting domestic violence that have been assaulted by men on the street. Like, that is a real situation.
Sure, but the novel sort of pulls them off the page before that happens.
Right, and says, thank goodness. The novel has also a very, and again, it kind of comes out of nowhere and then disappears in, off the page, but it has a two-page description of a woman being harassed in the street that is very accurate, very painful to read, because the thing is, she is sexually molested by someone, and then it describes the way nobody stands up for her.
Everybody
just watches and nobody says a word, and she gets like groped and slapped in the face, and everybody just stands around. So, and nobody takes her side. And it's awful. And it kind of, comes and goes. It certainly stays.
Although Rahel later takes revenge sort of for her on Yazid. Doesn't he recall, like, this is in part for you, med student whose name I can't remember, who got sexually harassed by
his
Yazid.
Motivations are a little, I don't know what his motivations are. It seems like he would always do. But I mean, what's interesting is in this huge sack of things that the book talks about, obviously we've now gotten into, gender relations and sex. And then that also links up with the cyber cafe, because there are customers of the cyber cafe who are using these online spaces basically to set up assignations, to sell sexual companionship, or to look for kind of romantic relationships. So that then is also a dimension of the book is sort of looking into, I mean, the relationships between men and women, which strike me as just as bad as the ones between men and men, or just as dire,
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, I think as I was reading the novel and translating the novel, and as other people have read it and we've talked about it, I think the discomfort that I felt, regarding these gender surrounding these gender relations, pretty palpable. I mean, pretty awful the way men are treating women, in the novel. But I think, I think what saves it in many ways is that nothing is spared. No relationships are secure. No relationships are trusting. No relationships are genuine, comforting or comfortable. The relations between men and women, they're different, but they're no worse. And I would argue they're no worse than the horrible relationships, between anyone, between any two people or between any group, in the novel.
Right. And it makes sense if you're telling the story from a character like Rahel's point of view, it makes sense that there are more male characters, that the point of view is a sort of more male than female world, because his access to women and to women's point of view and to any empathy and understanding for women is probably limited. So there are a number of female characters. They are generally often introduced when they first appear with a sexualized physical description. And I think that's how he and the guys at the cafe perceive them. And that's what you're sort of, that reflects that reality.
Mm. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is I found this book interesting, for countless reasons, but one of the things I found interesting in it is that it does address Marrakesh and all the larger cities in Morocco's significant West African and migrant population. There are three of the characters who are regulars in the Internet Cafe. I think they're all from Nigeria, actually. Mm-hmm. And so it takes this as an opportunity of sort of the many things that he sort of observes and dissects about contemporary Marrakesh is the character's racism and sort of the phenomenon of racism in the city. And I think, you know, there are many moments that are uncomfortable in the descriptions that we see through Rahel's point of view and the way in which these characters are treated. And I wondered about the translation process of those sections and how you were thinking about reception from a US or UK or other Anglophone audiences.
That's a great question. I mean, it's interesting because you and I, Marcia, had talked some years ago, I think when we first met, and I had said something about the hardest thing. We were talking about my translation of Yusuf Fadl's A Beautiful White Cat, which is in many ways, in many, many ways, a very funny novel, funny and tragic at the same time. But it is a comedic novel, and it revolves around comedy and humor. And I think what I said at the time is the hardest thing to translate, that I find the hardest thing to translate, is humor. It's just, it can be so specific to a culture or to a context. I've come up with, I'm starting to expand my list of hardest things to translate. And this came up in a subsequent translation of Yusuf's work, A Shimmering Red Fish, and also in this book, which are gender relations, sex and gender relations, and race in Morocco. There are these sections that really, translating is never easy, and it's never, it's always slow, but I felt like I was particularly aware of the trickiness of these sections. So in terms of these three characters, Amelia, Flora, and Yakubu, three Nigerians who are, passing through Morocco on their way to Europe, but they of course, like so many migrants from sub-Saharan Africa, could get into Morocco, but could not get out of Morocco. And so they've been there. I don't think we know exactly how long they've been there, but we do know we know that they've been there for some time, and they could be there like so many others for 5, 10, 15 years or more, basically becoming permanent residents of Morocco. And I've seen very few depictions of this, this phenomenon in Morocco, in Moroccan literature. And it's very, these are characters who are fleshed out, as much as any of the other characters, I think. And they are the targets of some sort of vicious, cruel racism, mostly on the part of one character, Yazid, who is he's one of the characters I was alluding to before, who one of the few characters I would just as well never want to hear from again. just an awful, awful character. A misogynist, a racist, violent, cruel. And they are these Nigerian cyber cafe customers are sort of the targets of his overt racism. And to be honest, I wanted to get that tone right. I think tone, tone is so important in translation, but especially dealing with sort of sticky topics, you want to make sure that the tone is carried over into the translated language. And I hope that I don't think I changed anything. I don't think I softened anything or took anything out for US or UK audiences. I hope that the cruelty of the racism is clear enough to offend and to shock, but not repel a reader, I guess.
Right. I mean, it's always a question of, you know, is this the racism of the character? Are we meant to see this as kind of a critique of a character of a social, of a society of power relationships, or is this the racism of the narrative, you know, which I think you do get in a lot of literature, unconscious or semi-conscious, say, you know, racist narratives. But this, I think he's very much foregrounding a critique of racism. And Yazeed is one of those characters, I think, where we don't have backstory on him. We don't, mm-hmm. Nobody's trying to make us care about Rahel. Yes, he's a terrible character, sure, but we do know his whole life story. And you have to sympathize with him a bit. But Yazeed, I don't think we know anything about him.
And it's interesting. I think that's true. And I think actually Yazeed is kind of the most racist character, the most, I mean, he's also the one who sexually harasses, I think, a couple of characters. Lays hands right. on, mm-hmm. Is violent with one of them, although he gets his in the end. He's almost he is in some ways, and I don't know, this would be a question for the author, whether it's a deliberate that he's like a sharp tool that's being used to underline these things. He's so focused and so cruel. And without any, we have no sense of why, and maybe we're not supposed to even wonder why. It's inexcusable, I guess, maybe. Yeah.
I think, and the similarity between the scenes in which he behaves like this towards women, towards the African users of the cyber cafe, is that no one else participates in this behavior, but everybody stands around and lets him and doesn't stop mm-hmm. him from doing it.
And that is important. Yeah. I think
there's that level. Yeah. He's a villain. Nobody likes him. Rahel hates his guts. He's a bully. But the dynamic in these scenes is that he does these awful things and there's no countervailing force. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you to read another portion of the book that I think gets into a little bit the view of the book on sort of what the problem is in society and online about like group dynamics and people basically, you know, not being themselves or not standing up for themselves or not expressing themselves. And this is the passage about traffic in Marrakesh and in Morocco, mm-hmm. about driving.
Right. Yes. And if anyone has been in traffic in Marrakesh or Morocco or been in a shared taxi, this will resonate particularly well.
And nobody take it personal. We all generalize about driving in every country we go. And, you know, everybody has this, you know, have this, this is, and people will recognize also some of this. There are specificities, but of course, of course it's a funny generalization, but grounded in something real.
Vivid, if nothing else. This is how Moroccans are. And I'll step out of the narrative. I mean, the narrator, him or herself, is telling us this is how Moroccans are, generalizing. This is how Moroccans are. You know them well, Rahel. You just have to set the tone for them to follow you, as if they were a blind orchestra. It took you back to your nightly commutes from the cyber cafe to Moassin in the crowded Jemaa El Fna shared taxis. The conversations were always along the same lines. It was enough for a passenger to utter a sentence, just like that, randomly, for the rest to dive in after him. If he said that, quote, things have gone from bad to worse, The rest of the passengers would artfully provide evidence of how everything everywhere had crashed. If he said, quote, "Our country is beautiful and may God glorify Morocco," the passengers would fall over one another to enumerate the country's praiseworthy attributes. Taxi chatter is endless. Six passengers crowded in, two in the front seat next to the driver and four in the back. Still, they find enough comfort to chit-chat and gossip. As soon as the taxi stops at a red light, finding itself out in front, the driver moves forward to gain a meter or two. That's how he gets in front of the stoplight. All the drivers who are out in front move forward. And since, unfortunately, the Lord hadn't given Moroccans eyes on their backs, it was up to the cars behind them to honk and alert them to the fact that the light had turned green. Sometimes, some of the ones who haven't been raised well lean too heavily on the horn. Beep, beep, beep. Rage strikes the driver and he begins to protest. What's with these animals? They want to fly? And the chorus joins in. My friend, people have no patience anymore. God protect us. People have gone crazy. God lead us to safe harbor. You're only going to go where God takes you. All of them whistling the same tune, repeating the same words. Everyone shows solidarity with the driver. All the passengers reassure him. All of them, what a surprise, are forbearing, patient, submissive, not in a rush. And I'll stop there.
It's a great scene. I mean, again, it's a dark view of society. And I don't think it applies at all only to Moroccan society. But it's a well-rendered depiction of how, of sort of the fundamental problem that the book poses in a way. Is collective the
comments,
behavior.
Right. The comments sections being much the same as conversations in a shared taxi, being the same as echoed everywhere, that this is not something you can't blame the internet for it. But as you said earlier, Ursula, it's funny because the book itself sort of inhabits it, you know, the question differently. It does manage to step outside these frames that were created.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, I think that's what books do. Like, I mean, they affirm something else in their very existence that can be at odds with the content of their story, right? I mean, they always affirm the value of telling the story in the first place.
And the possibility of being original.
Right. Well, I mean, I enjoyed talking about this book with you both almost as much as I enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, it's true. It's one of those books that I've been continuously reciting little passages about, you know, telling people about, oh, there's this part, et cetera, et cetera. It's a book that's fun to talk about.
Yeah. And again, you know, like picaresque or something of that sort. I mean, it's a book of, I mean, obviously there's an overarching narrative, but it's a book of scenes, right? And it's a book of interactions, you know, that are so fun to sort of, or interesting to read, reread, and discuss.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to be with us today, Alex, and to talk about the book with us. Like I said, it was super interesting and it made me think about it in some ways that I hadn't.
It's my pleasure. And yeah, I mean, I'm always happy to talk about it with whoever. There are a few people who have read it as much as I have, and so it's always a pleasure to talk with people who have read it so closely and have so many wonderful insights. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. And I think we're going to wrap it up there for this time. We'll be back in a couple weeks. And thanks to everyone else for listening.
Yes, thanks everyone.
Thank
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.